Welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. The world's largest inland fishery, the Mekong Delta, feeds millions of people. It also supports the livelihoods of tens of millions, and it's at serious risk. Habitat loss is the result of industrial practices like the mining of sand. That's one in a range of threats that puts the Delta's annual income of $11 billion at risk. The dangers and solutions for reducing these threats is part of a new report by the World Wildlife Fund and its 25 partners called The Mekong's Forgotten Fishes. Jeff Opperman is the global freshwater lead scientist with the World Wildlife Fund. He says using a geographic approach and geospatial tools to continually map and monitor this vital region is key to mitigating the dangers.
The Mekong overall is by far the most productive freshwater fishery in the world. And we often don't see what's essential is the connectivity between these spaces. And understanding this mix of how much sediment is coming in and sea level rise and all that, you need to do very accurate mapping of elevations of the Delta to understand what's most at risk.
Jeff Opperman talks to Esri's John Lenihan about the threats and the solutions for saving the Mekong Delta's amazing fish and the industries that depend on it.
Hi, Jeff, and welcome to Esri and the Science Aware podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
So, Jeff, you've got a really impressive title at one of the world's largest environmental organizations, the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund. First, for our audience, can you remind us where the Mekong Delta is?
Yeah, so the Mekong Delta is, it's in Southeast Asia, primarily in Vietnam, and it is the very end of the river, the Mekong River, where it flows into the ocean. So it's flowing from the Himalayas throughout Southeast Asia and into the oceans.
Can you expand on how fundamental the Delta is to the surrounding area, both economically and environmentally?
Yeah, so it is indeed incredibly valuable, both from an economic and an environmental perspective. The Mekong's Delta supports a population of about 20 million people and agriculture and industry that collectively provides about a quarter of Vietnam's gross domestic product. Its cropland produces more than half of Vietnam's staple crops and nearly 90% of its rice exports. And that's really crucial because Vietnam is one of the top two or three rice exporters in the world. And so about 10% of the rice that is traded in global markets is coming from the Mekong Delta. So just in case people don't know or can't picture what a delta is, people can probably picture that rivers, big rivers, are usually brown. And that's because they are carrying sediment. They're carrying silt and sand. And rivers have energy, and that's how they can carry it. They're flowing. They're moving the sediment downstream. So the sediment that erodes off the mountains or erodes off of fields, that gets into the river and moves downstream. But when the river meets the ocean and it becomes incredibly flat and there's a tide and it goes back and forth, it loses that energy and it can't carry the sediment anymore. So the sediment drops out, and that's what builds a delta. So a delta is basically built by the river carrying sediment all that distance and then dropping it when it hits the ocean. And over time, over tens of thousands of years, that builds up into what is an incredibly productive landform, very agriculturally productive, very economically productive, also has a lot of value for fish, both from aquaculture and from wild capture fish. And in fact, WWF just recently released a report called The Mekong's Forgotten Fishes that talks all about the incredible value to people of the fish in the Delta, but also throughout the Mekong River.
This report that you're referencing, Jeff, also describes this as one of the most urgent examples of Delta decline globally, which is impacting a huge number of species of the forgotten fish that you mentioned, but also the agriculture that you hit on as well. Obviously, there's a lot at stake, both globally and especially for the Vietnamese people. Can you give us kind of a scope of the impact of these issues and the Delta decline?
Sure. And in fact, there's a set of challenges and impacts to that affect the whole Mekong River. And a lot of those do wind up coming home to affect the Delta at the very bottom of the river. Almost everything that happens upstream eventually will be affecting the Delta. And I've already talked about the incredible agricultural productivity of the Mekong Delta, which in fact is representative of deltas worldwide. Deltas represent less than 1% of the land of the world, but they produce about 4% of the world's food. So deltas overall are very productive. But switching gears and now thinking about the fish that are in the delta, the fish that are swimming up and down the river, the Mekong overall is by far the most productive freshwater fishery in the world. About 15% of all freshwater fish that are harvested are coming from the Mekong. And more than 5 million people are employed in the fishery sector. Over 2 million tons of fish are caught each year. But the fish throughout the delta and throughout the river, it's nearly 20% of Cambodia's economy and about 13% of the economy of Laos. So these are the countries that are upstream of Vietnam. So I think that's what that's painting a picture of, is this incredibly productive, environmentally valuable and economically valuable resource that is the overall river and the Mekong Delta, producing food, producing livelihoods, supporting livelihoods. And there are a bunch of threats that affect the whole river, that affect the fishery, and that affect the delta.
Can you just give us a sense of some of the fish species, and you just put a little bit of that into context for us?
So I've already talked about how it's the most productive fishery, meaning the harvest of fish that people consume, 15% of the world's harvest of freshwater fish. Another superlative, in addition to the giant fishery, is that the Mekong supports individually giant fish. It supports some of the biggest fish species in the world. In fact, the two largest freshwater fish species in the world are in the Mekong. And all these fish have the word giant in their name, just to keep it easy. So the Mekong giant catfish and the Mekong giant stingray, another fish called the giant barb. So you get the picture. These are giant fish. And the Mekong giant catfish is over 600 pounds. That's the size of a grizzly bear. The Mekong giant stingray is even a bit heavier. And it's so massive, it's really like a giant circle, a stingray. It could easily flop over a king-sized bed. That's how enormous these fish are. Another superlative is the sheer number of different species, over 1,000 species in the Mekong Basin. It's third only to the Congo and the Amazon rivers in terms of the total number of species. And those rivers are 7 to 8 times bigger. So the Mekong is packing in this incredible diversity of species in an area much smaller than the Amazon.
So everything you're describing here, Jeff, you've got fish over 500 pounds, but in the report, it refers to them as forgotten fishes. It's hard to believe that fish of that size and fisheries and kind of the diversity within the Mekong would be forgotten. Can you expand on that and why they're referred to as forgotten fishes?
Sure. You're right in the sense that so these individual fish are so dramatic that they make for great TV shows and nature specials and all that. But I think the reason we would refer to them as forgotten is that when governments and funders are making decisions about the river, this incredible resource tends to get overlooked. And so even though you would think on their face, how could you ever overlook or forget these species? When it comes to these important decisions, they tend to get overlooked and sacrificed. And for example, I just talked about how the most important fish that people catch for food tend to migrate, and often long distances. A series of hydropower dams are being built on the river that are fragmenting and blocking that movement. And that really changes the ability of these fish populations to thrive, persist, and therefore to support the people that depend upon them. So when we say forgotten, we mean forgotten at the most important time in the most important places where these decisions are being made about the future of the river.
So you mentioned earlier deltas are heavily impacted by river flow and slowing of river flow, but it's got to be carrying the sediment from upriver. And I don't know much, but I understand that dam building and putting dams on fast flowing rivers will impact the flow of water. Does that have a big impact on delta decline and the loss of sediment in the rivers?
Yes, exactly. So what I said earlier is about how the river has enough energy to carry sediments, and it carries it all over the ocean where it drops it. Imagine now a dam that's blocking the river, and behind the dam, rather than a swiftly flowing river current, you have essentially a long, very slow moving, barely moving reservoir. So when the river flows into the reservoir, that's where the sediment will drop out. So the sediment is dropping out in a reservoir, and the reservoir then is releasing mostly sediment-free water. And if there's a series of dams, they can wind up capturing much of the sediment. In fact, that's happening all around the world. There's 50,000 major dams around the world. They're trapping about a quarter of the sediment that's in flux around the world. 100 billion metric tons of sediment have been captured behind dams. And that sediment that would have reached deltas, that would have reached the ocean, and including doing things like rebuilding beaches. And in some rivers, it's quite dramatic. I think the Nile River is more than 95% of the sediment is now captured behind dams. And getting back to the Mekong, there's been enough dam construction on the Mekong River and its tributaries that something around 70% of the sediment is now being captured behind those dams in those reservoirs, and therefore is not being carried to the delta. And that really is putting the delta at risk.
How is that measured, kind of the capturing of the sediment behind the dam? And then how is it demonstrated the impact of the downstream rivers, and in this case, the Mekong Delta? Do you use mapping tools, technologies? How do you go about that as a scientist?
Yeah, to really understand what would be happening, there are definitely mapping tools and spatial geographic analyses that you would do. For example, mapping where the sediment comes from. So in a river basin, different parts of the river basin produce different amounts of sediment. So that depends on the geology and the soil type and the slopes. So in general, mountainous areas, because they have slopes, when there's heavy rainfalls on a slope, it'll tend to produce more erosion. And that's the sediment that gets into the river as opposed to flat areas. So you can use mapping tools to understand where the sediment is. And then the sediment gets into the river, and you can then map it or route, understand the pathways that sediment travels. And then scientists are doing very fine scale mapping of the elevations in the delta. And of course, deltas, by their definition and how I described, it's where the river meets the sea and drops the sediment. So deltas, by definition, are just above sea level. And so they're always engaged in this kind of tug of war, like a boxing match with the ocean. The river is trying to build the delta up, and the ocean is trying to tear the delta down. And understanding this mix of how much sediment is coming in and sea level rise and all that, you need to do very accurate mapping of elevations of the delta to understand what's most at risk.
In some of the research I did, Jeff, one reason deltas around the world are under stress is mining of that sand that is actually building up and being captured. What is the effect on the Mekong Delta with respect to mining and taking some of those resources out?
Yeah, so you can think of the sediment that the river is carrying as the income. That's the annual income for the delta. So it needs income flowing in to stay balanced. The mining of sand in the delta itself or the river channels, that's like going after the savings accounts, because that's the sediment that's in storage in those places, in the river, the bank, the bed, the floodplain, the delta. That's all sediment that's in the long-term storage, like a savings account. So if you're losing your income through the reservoirs trapping the sediment, and then you're also having your savings account being depleted, you can see how that's a 1-2 punch that's very difficult for deltas, because they're losing both that, the annual replenishment and what's been built up over time. And so that's how those two activities are really putting the Mekong Delta in jeopardy. If these trends continue in terms of the amount of sediment that's being taken out of the system, more than 90% of the delta could be underwater by the year 2100. And so just revisit what I said at the beginning, about 20 million people, a quarter of Vietnam's GDP, gross domestic products, and 10% of the rice that's it traded in global markets, and then think about that being underwater, you can see that it's really quite remarkable what's at stake, and the need for solutions is urgent.
Diminishing buildup of sediment and also removal, more going out than coming in, is subject to a host of risks. I can imagine deepening of the delta channel, salt water flowing back. Are there other physical kind of issues that are happening within the delta's ecosystem because of the lowering of the sediment?
Yeah, so you mentioned deepening of channels, lowering of surfaces, and you combine that with sea level rise. And so another major challenge is that salt water is moving further and further upstream. And that would make sense that if the surface is getting lower, even as the sea level is rising, you are going to have salt water moving further upstream. And so that's a major problem for the people that are depending on using the water for irrigation or for drinking. And another thing that affects deltas around the world is as people pump groundwater, or in some deltas pump oil, these are liquids, water or oil, that are taking up space under the delta. As they're being pumped out, it actually causes the subsidence, the lowering of what's above it. So that's yet one more way that deltas are being impacted in terms of their battle to stay above sea level. And then another thing is this channelization that people do. So people will build levees or dikes or walls along as the river is flowing through the delta. It often breaks into multiple different channels. And so rather than that sediment being allowed to just spread around the delta, as the water rises and falls, that water is channelized and it shoots off and can't rebuild the delta. So in some places like the Mississippi Delta, they are now putting notches in these levees, in these walls, to allow the water to flow out and rebuild the delta in that way.
So Jeff, your report also outlines how 85% of major deltas across the globe are experiencing severe flooding. Is part of that due to the pressure to erect dams and put dams up and create electricity for the local community or elsewhere?
Yeah, so I think I was mentioning earlier this, the number of dams worldwide and built for electricity, built for other water storage, for irrigation, for water supply, that dams are trapping approximately a quarter of the global annual flux of sediment. So how much sediment would be moving in rivers annually? So it's people and their dams are beginning to act like a major geological force that's affecting this relationship between land, rivers, deltas, and oceans. And really, interestingly, what's affecting the health of the delta is often very similar to the things that are negatively impacting the fish and the health of the river overall. So when we look for solutions, fortunately, there are some solutions that are going to work well for protecting fish and also work well for trying to maintain deltas.
So you protect and save the delta, you essentially save and protect the fish and in the community that participates. It makes me think of the concept of wildlife corridors, right? In green space and protecting, you know, wildlife going over highways, bridges, etc.
Yeah, we often think of the world, going back to the map idea, as areas, distinct, here's a park and here's a city and here's a different park. And we often don't see what's essential is the connectivity between these spaces. Wildlife often need to move also to breed and genetic diversity and all that. Same with fish, the importance of connectivity corridors where the river and its tributaries are the connectivity corridors. And then deltas depend on the connectivity of sediment delivery.
So this idea of connectivity is a great segue into the idea of spatial technology. Can you give some examples of how spatial technology is helping identify deltas at risk and solutions and plans that can be put in place to address some of the issues these deltas are facing globally?
I'll focus here on the Mekong and some work that I was part of, some research where we did use mapping tools and spatial analysis to look at the proposed dams, because there's still dozens and dozens of dams that are being proposed for the Mekong. And we used spatial analytical tools to see which of those dams would have the most impact on sediment, and what are the ways that if countries were to choose dams strategically, what are the ways that they could build and increase hydropower generation while minimizing impacts to sediment? And there's very clear ways that can be done. Primarily, if new dams are built upstream of existing dams, there's very little additional impact on either sediment or migratory fish. And so using these spatial tools, we could identify basically development pathways that would minimize impacts on fish and sediment and therefore the delta while delivering the same amount of electricity as plans that are going forward that are having much bigger impacts on fish and the delta.
So that's one example of a solution, right? Or at least a planning solution. Can we talk about some other solutions, maybe your top three that kind of you think are the most achievable to repair and protect deltas? And then maybe specifically, as you think about the forgotten fish, are there solutions that you're helping spearhead and identify for the forgotten fish of the Mekong Delta?
You may have heard of the concept of marine protected areas, which is in the ocean context, a part of the ocean that is designated for no fishing. And it really allows overfished populations to have a place where they reproduce and grow and without any pressure from fishing. And then the theory is there's essentially there's spillover effects where that productivity of fish in the protected area then is supplying fish in other parts of the ocean that can be caught. Well, some communities have been doing that in Thailand and in Laos, and they're finding great success that in relatively quick time, these fish reserves are having dramatic increases in the number of fish, the total weight, biomass of all the fish that's in there. So it shows that with these community-led initiatives and protecting a resource, it can really build fish populations back up. And then those fish populations, because they migrate, will be moving to other parts of the river system where they can be caught for people. I mentioned this strategic planning of hydropower dams. Even more broadly, strategic planning of energy systems can be a way to identify how could a country build a low carbon grid that is economically cost competitive, but do it in a way that minimizes the kind of impacts that I've been talking about. I've been talking about impacts of hydropower dams on migratory fish, impacts on sediment and deltas. And I've been part of research, and there's been a number of research studies on the Mekong and other systems that show that particularly with the incredible drop in cost of wind and solar, that countries now can build very cost competitive grids in ways that avoid the most damaging hydropower dams. Hydropower is part of those grids already, and sustainably sited hydropower could be part of those grids, but really avoiding these dams that are having such negative impacts on migratory fish would be a solution for countries if they could implement that. And the final thing I'll say is that there's this term nature-based solutions, where we let nature provide a service to people that we often otherwise would do with infrastructure. For example, trying to protect from erosion the delta. So you could build seawalls, you could just dump concrete and try to reduce the erosive force of the waves. But a nature-based solution is to plant and nurture mangroves. And mangroves will also absorb the energy of waves. And the good thing about mangroves is they'll capture the sediment, and the roots will capture the sediment and help build land. And so they're actually raising the elevation as they work and resisting the wave energy. And another nature-based solution I referenced earlier is simply opening up levees and just letting floodwaters spread the sediment around, and then it deposits out. So really just unleashing a river to behave like a river, and then it could be a nature-based solution to spread sediment, raise the delta, and help keep people safe.
Jeff, I just wanted to say thank you for joining us on the podcast. It's been a fascinating discussion. Personally, thanks for helping me understand the importance of deltas on the world's fish primarily, but also on the agriculture and all the economies that are really driven and supported by these deltas in major river systems. Really appreciate it.
Great. Yeah, great to talk to you, and really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. And thanks to Jeff Opperman for explaining how location technology helps safeguard a vast natural resource that millions depend on for food and power. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.